At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Today we are digging into a case that has been dissected, dramatized, and distorted for decades. John Wayne Gacy. But this time it's a little different. Peacock's new series, Devil in Disguise, John Wayne Gacy. It strips back the folklore and gets to the core of what really happened. How a man with 33 confirmed victims was able to operate in plain sight for years. To do that, we are joined by series showrunner and executive producer Patrick McManus, actor Michael Chernus, who plays John himself, and attorney Bob Mata, whose father was actually part of Gacy's original defense team. And I want to set some ground rules for everybody right away. We are going to have to all speak like your character did, Michael, in the show, with the kind of northern, folksy accent through the duration of this. So. Get ready to step back into it, everybody. I got it out of me after leaving Wisconsin, but I can dive back in. Is everybody good with that? Are we
good? Good with it?
Okay. All right. Yeah. You know, let's start here. This is, the series is coming out on Peacock, may already be out by the time you're watching this, based on the docuseries. Patrick, I want to start with you. What made you think, hey, let's take the John Wayne Gacy story and let's tell it in a way that, that no one's done thus far?
Well, to be honest, that was the first of all, thank you so much for having us. And there's a reason why I'm a writer, so I will not be trying to do the accent.
Anyway,
you look, I started as an actor and someone made it very clear I should be a writer for sure. So I will just say that at first I turned the show down a couple of times before I said yes. And the reason that I had turned it down was that I just genuinely didn't think that there was something else to tell. I didn't think that we should get into telling the story of John Wayne Gacy as a serial killer. And on the third time, the studio, Universal Content and Peacock asked me to do it. I said, okay, but I want to find a new way in. And and that way in was to try to focus it on the families, on the police, on the lawyers, and on the victims. I knew what the first three meant. I didn't really know at the time that I said it what focusing on the victims meant. Yeah. But the studio, the network, from that day to today, have been extraordinarily supportive of that. And it wasn't until we got into the writer's room that we really figured out what we ended up calling these short stories, which were. We had to pick obviously only a select group of the victims, but our goal was to tell their a snapshot of their life stories without any connection to John Wayne Gacy. And so these short stories sort of stand alone. They, if you took them out of the show, the true crime aspect of the show would continue unabated. But by putting them into the show, it really is the thing that I think sort of stands the genre on its head. By not focusing solely on John Wayne Gacy's story, you also are making a statement that this is ultimately not about the serial killer. This is about the path of sort of destruction that he left behind. And to me and to the writers, and I'll let Michael speak obviously for himself, I think for the actors and the directors, it really did make it a reason to actually make the show.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it shows the human. I mean, because it's easy to go to the horror of John Wayne Gacy. I mean, that's what he's a legend now. I mean, it's the lore. It's the horror of it. But there's real human beings behind this. I mean, granted, you know, we're going back many a years, and it seems, you know, in our world, I don't know what the cutoff is, but there seems to be some point where, well, if it was that long ago, we start to lose that sense of humanity of who these people really were, of what their lives were like, and what was stolen from these families, you know, through John's horrible, you know, deeds. How did you guys go about getting into the real life stories of the people? Was this based on things that have been documented over the years? Did you get a chance to have conversations with any of the victims' families? What was that process like?
Well, work in reverse, and I'll just say first and foremost, we reached out to all of the family members that we could find, and we reached out by email, by phone, by letter. We sent over 30 letters, trying to make contact with as many as we could. And at the end of the day, we made contact with five family members, you know, it wasn't an attempt to get their blessing. It was really an attempt to just have a conversation, to let them know that this is what was happening. We didn't want them to be taken by surprise. We wanted them to be able to say whatever they wanted to say to us about it. And with all honesty, the response back that we got was a version of good luck. Like we hope, we wish you well. And so at the end of the day, I think for the writers, for the actors, we're just hoping that we didn't let them down. As it relates to the research, you know, it all began with the documentary that was on Peacock. So we had all of the research that NBC News had provided to us. And then I have a personal researcher who's worked with me on a few shows who really does a very, very deep dive into every nook and cranny of the stories that we are trying to tell. Up to and including for him, we flew him to Chicago, and he actually stood in what I can only imagine looked like, you know, the last scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where, you know, they kept all of the evidence. And he just, Patrick is his name, Patrick Murphy. He reports back with literally thousands of pages of annotation of research. And that was really the foundation, along with the NBC News research, of everything we did. And one of the goals that we had for Patrick was, give us as much as you can give us on these victims so that we can try to build a picture of their lives as best we can.
Yeah. And then try to combine it down into, I mean, granted, you get 10 episodes. It's better than like a 2-hour, you know, movie. You have more room to tell the story, but then there's just so much in a story like this. I mean, another idea I just was running through my mind when you were talking about reaching out, you could have sent Michael out, you know, with some balloons and makeup and knocked on doors. Hey, we'd like to tell a story. What do you guys think? You know, that might have been a little distasteful, but I think, you know, it would have gotten the point across. Michael, obviously you did a phenomenal job in this. I've been watching it and I'm just like, this is a good one. This is one that, you know, it's one of those rewatch series, in my opinion, where you watch it once and then a couple months later, I think I want to see that again. What was the process in this for you? You get the call from your agent saying, hey, they think you look a lot like Gacy. Can you put on some makeup and come downtown and show it off? Or how did that work for you?
I had been told previously in my life that I looked like Gacy. And
really?
Yeah. People had said over the years that, you know, you should think about, you know, optioning some rights or something.
Sure.
You know, I was not drawn to that. I, you know, for all the obvious sort of reasons. And my agent called and said they want you to audition for this series. You know, you should take a meeting first with Patrick to find out how they're going to approach it.
Yeah.
And my agent knows Patrick. And so she's like, he's a good guy. I can vouch for him. I think this will be respectful, but you should have a conversation. And I was very hesitant. You know, I just was like, I don't know. You know, part of me was just like, I don't know if I want my name tied to his name for all time, you know? And Patrick and I had what was supposed to be like a 20-minute Zoom conversation that turned into like an hour, real deep dive. And when he told me that there wouldn't be any murder on screen, so it wasn't going to be some, you know, gory, salacious thing. Yeah. And then when he told me this idea of these flashback stories of some of the victims and that we get to really meet them before they ever cross paths with John Wayne Gacy, that was really compelling to me. So I was like, I've never seen anything like that. The closest thing is like on Orange is the New Black, when you would see some of the inmates before they ever went to prison, to just humanize those people and not make them a number. So that, and then, and Patrick said to me, he was like, you know, just so you know, you're not going to be in every scene. And most actors who would be auditioning to play a lead in something would kind of be upset about that. And I was like, thank God. Thank God. That's such a relief that I don't have to carry this whole thing. And so then I there was a series of auditions, both over Zoom and in person. And I met Patrick for the first time in New York City on the day of the big eclipse. And
That's creepy.
I know.
No.
Everyone's outside looking at with their eclipse glasses, and I was going to go.
For Gacy. Walk me through, Patrick. I mean, when you're looking to find who's going to be the best Gacy, did you think, you know, like Michael's got this, you know, out of the gate, just kind of knowing his previous work and the fact that, of the resemblance that exists? Or what are you looking for when you're auditioning folks to play Gacy? Because this is an interesting character. He's dark, he's evil, but he's kind of likable. I mean, that's an interesting one to try and find that balance. How did that process go?
So the answer to that is really twofold. I mean, look, Michael's resume and his work speaks for itself. And if you watch anything that he's been in, or if you've seen any theater that he's done, you know he's got it.
Yeah.
So quite a bit of the audition process is a little bit like how I think about hiring writers, which is, do I want to hang out with you? Right. Yeah. Like, is this going to be a partnership? Right. Because like so often I've been doing this for 14 years running shows. And so often there's like a general approach of like the actor's over here and you're over here. I don't appreciate that. I don't agree with that. And for me, working with the actors and treating them like true partners is really, really important. And on this one, it was more important than on any of the other shows that I've ever worked on because of the subject matter that we were dealing with and also because of the approach that we're dealing with. So some of it was just, are we going to see eye to eye on the approach and is that going to work? And within literally like seconds of talking to him, I knew that those boxes were going to be checked. So if you ask me, like, did I know right from the start that it was Michael? The answer to that is yes, so long as he didn't say put me in every scene, right?
Sure.
And,
yeah.
Right. And so long as he understood what we were like trying to do, and he just did. And that carried from that day forward. I mean, like, I just to go into the partnership thing, there's this also general idea sometimes that you have to treat actors as if they are like some like breakable thing and that you have to protect them from the unknown things that go on. And for this show, it was so important that I told Michael everything and that Michael knew all the pitfalls, all the speed bumps, everything that was going to come at us at any given time, because it just was, to me, this show is more special than anything I've done before. And I mean that with the utmost of respect to what I've done before. And I genuinely think it's more special than anything that I'm probably going to do again. And I mean that with all due respect to the things down the road. Sure. And so I will say I was asked to meet with a lot of actors, right? Like, and that's just part of the process.
Sure.
But there isn't a question in my mind that once Michael's tape went to the powers that be, I mean, it was within literally an hour of me sending it that everyone was like, it's Michael. And then the last bit that I'll just say to answer what you're saying. Yeah. One of the challenges that I had as a writer, one of the challenges that our writers had as writers, one of the challenges, I will again let Michael speak for himself, but I think he had the challenge as well, which is that like your instinct when you're dealing with a serial killer is to make them feel like a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that John Wayne Gacy was was also quote unquote special in that genre, right? Like he, because of the fact that he was so affable, because of the fact that he was so a part of the community, like our instinct as writers is to make him seem evil, but we had to constantly push against that because that was who he really was. He was somebody that you, you know, quote, want to have a beer with, right? Mm-hmm. And that is instinctually as you don't want to do that. You don't want to like him, but mm-hmm. that was the thing that we consistently had to row towards, and be it the writers, be it the actors, be it the directors, right? Be it in editorial, like the choices that we made of the looks that he makes is to make sure that people understood why he was able to get away with it for as long as he did. And Michael, you know, for with all due respect, Michael, and all love, he embodied it.
Yeah. Bob Mata with us, defense attorney, Bob Mata Jr. Bob's dad was on his legal team. He was one of Gacy's attorneys. Bob, one of your gifts you got, correct me if I'm wrong, from your father was the tapes, was tapes of Mr. Gacy himself. And you got to hear, and your dad obviously, you know, knew firsthand what it was like, you know, what this man was like. Can you speak to that? The portrayal of John in the series, he's exactly what we just described. He is kind of likable for being the character that he is. What was your dad's impression, and what did you glean off of those tapes when you got those back in the day?
Well, so I did a podcast, which I hope all of you listened to. I'm assuming you did. The show sounds like it's an awful lot like my podcast in terms of I didn't want to necessarily focus on Gacy at all, because mm-hmm. it had been done ad nauseum. I wanted to focus on the victims, which I did, the arrest, the investigation, which only went 10 days with the Splains, and then obviously the trial, as my dad was one of the trial attorneys. And so I went into the podcast. I'm like, oh man, you know, I'm going to have my father. I've got, like, this is a shoe-in in terms of the interviews that I was lining up for that. So I asked my father, the first thing I asked him is, what was your impression of John Wayne Gacy when you first met him? And this is in the podcast. He says to me, Bob, he was an arrogant prick is what he said, which really kind of articulated it in a way that after I listened to the tapes, because I had the tapes for 30 years and never fully listened to them. Because they're that disturbing. And
you didn't put them in like your car, like when you're like mixtapes for girlfriends. It's no, like, here's no. Ace of Base, here's Lionel Richie, no. And here's a little snippet of John.
Yeah, no.
Wow, you know, Ace of Base.
Yes. All right. I saw the sign.
Skipping in deep. All right. No, I really didn't. Oddly enough, I got them for my 21st birthday, and I'm in my 50s now, so I had them for a long time. It was my friends that had that kind of just morbid interest and curiosity that really wanted to listen to them more than I did. And then, you know, but as in Michael, I did a quite a bit of voice acting in my podcast of trying to get into the mind of Gacy. And it's a scary, weird place to be. So, you know, I can really feel where you're coming from with respect to, you know, you kind of really getting into that character, because to me, and, you know, obviously is that being a weird part of my life since I was 10 years old and really knowing everything about the whole story because of my father's involvement in the case, I was like, man, this dude was the scariest of them all because of everything that Patrick was just talking about. This, his ability to be this chameleon where he's just so affable and likable. He was like, I would always say he was kind of like the Norm character in Cheers when he'd walk in the bar. And it was true. He was that guy, you know, yeah. to the people that knew him, they really, really liked him and enjoyed him. You know, but he just had that switch that it was always lurking. It was always there. You know, it wasn't like, you know, when it was kill time, whether, you know, when he goes out to troll at 2 a.m. and, you know, ends up as kill time is usually early morning hours. You know, I mean, it was always lurking, and you saw it most when he kind of, you know, lost sight of what worked for him in terms of being able to operate for so long with Robert Peace, his last victim, where he just kind of, he put it all out there in terms of how he operated. And, you know, it was so evident that it was clear that Rob Peace had been snatched up by Gacy that, you know, he had to have known at that point that he was
he was going to get caught, you know? So it was, yeah, man. Michael, I hope that you were able to listen to the tapes. Cause like hearing him, his callousness, his ability to not have any remorse or thought whatsoever about these kids' lives that he ended was beyond chilling, man.
Michael, how did you get into the character for like, what did you do to get yourself prepared to really, to get in the skin of Gacy, you know, pardon the dark pun there, but to be him and to play him in the unique way that this character needs to be played?
Well, first of all, thanks. Everyone, thanks for having me here. I'm so excited that Bob Mata Jr. is here. I said before we started recording, I feel like I'm meeting a little kid meeting a celebrity or something. Because I did listen to the DeVents Diaries, the John Gacy tapes a lot. What an incredible resource that was for me. I know that wasn't the intention in releasing those tapes, but for me, there isn't a ton of, you know, there's hardly any video footage of him. There's really just two kind of main interviews, and those are way after he'd already been convicted and been incarcerated for a long time. So to have access to his, not just his speaking voice, but just his mind, for lack of a better word, so shortly after he'd been arrested, that was just, it was an incredible insight. Yeah, I mean, I agree with your dad. I think John Gacy was an arrogant prick, and I don't find him charming. I understand what people mean when they say he was charming, but I don't think he was very charming. I think he was persuasive. I think he was manipulative. I think he was actually a good actor. He knew how to read a room. He knew what other people wanted him to be in any moment. So if they needed him to be the jolly joker, happy neighbor, he could do that. If they wanted him to be kind of raunchy, one of the guys, he could do that. If he needed to be kind of the Polish immigrant, you know, blue collar guy, he wore masks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The clown was just one of those many masks that I think, you know, has been wrongly portrayed in the media, that this idea of the killer clown, that was just like a small part of who he was. It was one of the many clubs and faces that clubs he belonged to and faces that he wore to slip by. You know, he got away with it for so long. He would, you know, make cops feel uncomfortable by talking about homosexuality, and they just like kind of turn the other cheek. So to get into him, I think I thought about it a lot in that way, that there were just these multiple Johns. I mean, he even said it, and there were all these different Gacys, and trying to just think in any given scene, like, which version am I embodying? Mm-hmm. You know, we knew that we did never want to do like the mustache twirly kind of like evil serial killer thing, that it was more subtle than that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. Early on, I was like, I don't know. I sort of didn't know how to embody him because he's such a mystery. And Bob, you talk about that on the podcast. Like, this guy was also just, you know, forgive my French, but he was batshit crazy too. Mm-hmm. So like, there's no logic, really. He goes one way and then he goes another, and then he's saying he did do it, and then he's saying he didn't do it. So for me, it eventually became that thing of like, who am I talking to, and what do they want? Who do they want me to be, and how can I manipulate them, and how can I appear harmless until that final moment when I am very harmful? But I was very afraid to be charming. I didn't want people to like him. Yeah. I didn't want the audience to go away and be like, I like him. And then I think Patrick said to me, like, you have to go there, because then we understand why someone would get in that car, why someone would take that job at PDM, why someone mm-hmm. would, you know, share a beer with him or share a joint with him. We have to understand that. And as an audience, also kind of experience that of like being drawn in by him and then realizing who he is.
Man, I'm really excited to see your performance, man, because I mean, you, what you were just saying really kind of embodies exactly what he was. And you know, and I've seen, obviously there's been a few movies out, you know, with various different actors, but in terms of what you just said, and I know the your chops in terms of your acting skills, because I've seen quite a few things that you've been in, man. I'm really excited to see it, man. I am. I think that it sounds like you guys nailed this thing.
I'm excited for you to see it, Bob, because like I was very inspired by your podcast and a number of other, and you know, I know the book, but Boys Enter the House, this aspect of the story of just what was lost is really what our show is about, you know.
Yeah.
And when people are taken from us in their youth, in their prime, any death is tragic, but it's just it's unconscionable, like ripping away someone, you know, when they have a summer job, or when they're just bought a car, or they just had their first girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, like, you know, it's like kids in high school, kids just out of high school, like man, the fact that this guy got the airtime that he got in the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s was just, it was so wrong. He's an uninteresting, despicable human being. I love that you called him the creep, Bob, that you wouldn't even say his name after a while in the podcast. That really stuck with me.
Thank you, man.
The horror of him, he has a folksy appeal to him. And I think it may hit people different depending on where you are in the country or where you grew up in the country. Bob grew up, you know, there in that area. I grew up in that general area too. People did kind of talk like that. I feel like I knew many of people that on the surface, you know, were kind of Gacy, like a lot of used car dealers, but you know, there was that level of, you know, you didn't quite know what was going on with some people behind the curtain, and you know Gacy, obviously, it was far more extreme than anyone could have imagined. I wonder, at the end of the day, and I'll ask you this, Michael, do you think John knew exactly who he was, or was he just such a chameleon? He's always just changing skins because he was so uncomfortable in his own that he didn't know who he was. We see it in the Brian Koberger case, where he seemed to be always taking different snippets of different horrible characters from the past. I mean, including even fictional ones like Norman Bates and the American Psycho character to make up who he is when we look at who he became with the horrible Idaho murders. There are seemingly remnants of that here with Gacy, of the constant chameleon, constantly, I'm going to play the room to whoever the crowd is the best I can for whatever my narcissistic needs are. Again, long question, but do you think John knew who he was?
I don't think he knew who he was. I don't think he had a real level of self-awareness in that sense. But I do think he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I do think that I don't buy into the theory that he was like killing off parts of himself that he hated, or that he wasn't comfortable in his skin. I think if he was born straight, he would have killed women. I think he was a psychopath. I think he was a true psychopath. Yeah. And I think that, you know, he claimed that when he killed Tim McCoy, his first victim, he had an orgasm. Mm-hmm. And I think like there was a real bloodlust thing. I think it got him off.
Yeah.
And I think he was like hunting. He was out every night. I mean, he killed 33 people that we know of, and that's a huge number, but he picked up thousands of guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He let a lot of them go. He tortured a lot of them. Some of them, he brought them back to his house and just talked and got high and passed out on the couch. I mean, he was always seeking something: booze, drugs, sex. He, I think he was like an addict in that sense. Mm. And I don't believe that he was killing any of his victims because they were gay or he thought they were gay. It was always if they cheated him out of money, if they changed the price on him, if they said they were going to tell his neighbors or his friends that he was picking up boys, if you know, they were blackmailing him. It was always like if he felt he was being wronged, if he was being a victim, if he was being backed into a corner, then he would kill someone. So it was always just about him. He was a narcissist. It was just
massive narcissist.
And it was all just self-protection. Like if he felt like, even with Rob Peast, he said he was probably going to let him go. And then Rob said, oh, gee, Mr. Gacy, I thought you were going to kill me there for a second. He was like, yeah, he planted that one seed you don't want planted. And
Patrick, how difficult is it to write for a character like that? That, I mean, obviously we have the documented history, but you're, you go in, you dramatize it, you're creating the dialogue that we don't know what happened in a lot of cases, of just what was this man like? What was his interactions with human beings? And someone who is kind of all over the board with their chameleon like tendencies, not just here's the character. How was that difficult to dive into his mind and go there?
The one thing that I'll say on that is, and I joke that I have like sociopathic tendencies, because I've done several pieces of true crime. I'm doing more true crime.
Yeah.
And I don't ever really get affected by it. I have a story I'll share in a moment, but in terms of compartmentalization and doing the work, I just do the work. Mm-hmm. In terms of crafting the dialogue and helping or having other writers help me craft the dialogue with the other scripts, you know, it really, so while there's no world in which we know for sure what conversations were had, if you do enough research, and we just waded into research, you get snippets of conversations, because you're if not whole conversations, and you're able to sort of piece together a general idea of who people were and what they said and how they responded to things. And specifically with Gacy, as I alluded to before, my biggest challenge at the beginning was figuring out how to not write him as a serial killer. Like, mm-hmm. that was the biggest challenge. And I do want to share a quick anecdote about Michael. So at the time that he read, and then even in like the early days of rehearsals and things like that, it was all sort of the masks of Gacy, right? To use what Michael said, right? There was this one rehearsal that we did with actually the young man who played Tim McCoy. And we were in this like conference room that we converted into a rehearsal space for a second on the lot. And I was sitting in the back of the room at a table with a couple of other producers and writers. And it was in that rehearsal, for the first months into the process, that I saw behind the mask for the first time on Michael. And because I'd just been spending so much time in the masks, that was all we had been doing. And in this rehearsal, where he is sitting on a couch, it's just Michael and the young man who was playing Tim McCoy. And the actor was leaning forward because he was eating something, and he was pretending to eat something. And Michael was leaning back. And this is from a later episode. And so we at the table could see Michael's performance for the first time as the mask dropped. And it was like, and we knew, we all looked at each other. First of all, it was chilling. It was genuinely chilling. But secondly, we knew it worked. Like, we knew in that moment that because of all the work we had done in trying to craft this, and I will use the term affability, right? This affable character, we knew that moment that the mask dropped, that we'd accomplished what we were trying to accomplish, like, perfectly. And Michael just, it was the most haunting, terrifying, simple. Like, it was so, so simple to us. To him, I'm sure it was very complicated, but it was just absolutely brutal, that moment that the mask dropped. So I will say that finding that balance between the two was the most challenging aspect of the job that I had as writers, and that I think our fellow writers had as well.
Did you have that exact same experience when they were feeling the mask was dropping, Michael? What was going through your mind as that was happening?
You know, I don't know how to say this in the right way, but it actually wasn't complicated. I think, like, I knew that there was this part of him that, when no one was looking, was very different from all the other parts of him when someone was looking. Mm-hmm. And that the man in private was like a bit like a shark, you know, just stalking his prey. And in a weird way, like, that's not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a,
It's the nature of who he was. And I mean, to others looking in, with others looking, when we look at it, we're like, how does, because it's like, it's nothing we would do as human beings as ourselves.
Yeah.
But when you have to go behind the prism of that person and go, okay, how is this person seeing reality? What's motivating this person? That's what's spooky about it. But once you get it, once you know the person, it's like, oh, that's like A plus B equals C in this person's mind. And that is,
Yeah, like, let me jump in. And I, in my estimation, he was the most terrifying apex predator that ever existed in terms of his ability to be able to do that. Just and Michael, you nailed it. I mean, the dude was literally a shark, you know. And I mean, the man never slept. Like his ability to be able to function in terms of, because, you know, PDM was pretty successful. I think by today's standards, you know, he was making $500,000 a year with this business he had, which he traveled with constantly. And then, and as Patrick said, I mean, he hunted every night. There was never a time when he wasn't out. So, you know, in that thought process, and really kind of when, and I don't know if you guys were able to get into, like, I'm assuming you do with Peast, and, you know, everything that he did in that moment, and that as soon as he laid his eyes on Rob Peast, he knew, you know, leaving the, you know, his Bible, which was his appointment book, behind intentionally. And then Torf calls him and says, "Hey, John, you left your book here." And then him waiting until 10 minutes before 9 to go back, you know, and then Miss Peast and him just kind of like ships passing in the night with her son going out and following Gacy and her coming in. It's, I mean, the dude was heavily premeditated, you know, but it would be in the moment. Like, he didn't have to premeditate for days. Like, he could premeditate something in a moment because he was just so patterned in what he did. And, like, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Patrick, in terms of when you guys get to the kind of the investigation part, because when I interviewed all these old Des Plaines cops, which was a fascinating experience for me because, you know, my dad's involvement in the case, but, you know, and I'm very tough in my podcast on the Chicago police. You know, the Chicago police in general, in my estimation, are directly responsible for probably about 29 of those homicides. I lay it out in, I think, my third episode, when after he'd killed Johnny Bukovich, and I'm like, man, they had everything they needed. Like, when you guys are kind of researching it, and I had talked to Tracy quite a bit, who had done the documentary going into my podcast, and she'd given me a lot of her research going into it. And, you know, and I knew she had a different angle than I was going to take when I was doing the pod, but, you know, and I really did want to focus on the investigation. Do you guys kind of delve into the lack of police work by Chicago police in particular, and their, just their view of homosexuality back at that point in time, and the frustration that these parents felt by just having these cops over and over. And so, like, just saying your kid just ran away, you know, and then, you know, having a brief conversation where the couple of times when Gacy was on the radar and he's just saying, "Oh yeah, like, he came and got his last check and he told me he was fucking off to California, you know." And, but the kid leaves his car, his prized possession, behind in his wallet. You know, it's like, are you guys able to get into that? Because I'm really excited. I obviously haven't seen the screener, and there's just, it's such ripe territory.
So with each of the shows that I've done so far, and the shows that are on the docket for the future, there is a theme that runs through them very purposefully, which is systemic failure. Yeah. And with Dr. Death, it was the failure of the medical community. With Girl from Plainville, it was there, all of these missed opportunities in terms of mental health. And with Devil in Disguise, it is probably one third of the show is analyzing dramatically, right? I mean, we have 8 episodes to be able to do it, but that is a massive part of it. And what's interesting about it is that you sort of have the police on two different sides, right? Which is, you've got Chicago PD and the failure of them to stop him, as you laid out, and I won't repeat. Yes, we do absolutely explore that. But on the flip side of it, you also have all of these police who are in the pit, who are trying to figure out how many victims there are that are genuinely become broken heroes because of the time they spend down there. And so what I appreciate about this story is that we're not demonizing, right? We are simply telling the truth. And the truth was, Chicago PD did not have the communication, if you want to be as generous as you can possibly be, to be able to share what John Wayne Gacy was doing And on the flip side, you had a deeply, deeply prejudiced prejudice department, which was not just about homophobia, but it was about socioeconomic conditions as well. Criminal backgrounds of kids, right, that they just dismissed. And then on the other side, you do have these police who are genuinely trying to do a good. And so we do explore both sides of those coins because we don't want to demonize. We want to just tell the as close to a version of the truth of the story as we can possibly do in 8 episodes of storytelling.
Awesome. Yeah.
And let the people who are going to be demons be demons, basically, by their own actions. Reality in a case like this, oftentimes it's scarier, it's more disturbing than what one could even put on a screen. Did you run into that at all? Were there any moments here when you're going through the story and you're because obviously there's a lot here. There's only so much, you know, only so many of the pieces of the story that can fit into the show. Did you ever run into any moments where you're like, this is reality, but I don't know that it's so out there. It's so extreme as to what his actions were that this might be hard for them to even grasp, or fearing that the audience is going to think we added this in for dramatization, but it's really the reality of what he did.
You want me to take that, Michael, or do you want to take it?
Yeah, go for it.
It's one of the short answer to your question is no. Mm-hmm. But there's a reason for it. Like, because we are not showing any of the murders, we're not showing any of the rapes, we're not showing any of the assaults, because we are leaving that on the side, the show becomes about something more. Yeah. And so I genuinely believe that if we leaned into dramatized what actually happened, first of all, I wouldn't have done the show. Mm-hmm. Because I do think it's too extreme. I think that it's unnecessary. I think it's gratuitous. I think it's salacious. Like I from the very beginning had no interest in doing it. There is nothing about this story, if you really show it, that deserves to be on television.
Sure.
And it would be a disservice to the lives of the victims to show it, and to not just the living, but the deceased family members as well. There is nothing about him that should be shown on television, but there is absolutely a reason to, as I said at the very beginning, to show the absolute wreckage that he left in his wake. And I'll say one last thing. There are a couple of moments in the show where we very strategically, cinematically walked up to the line and then stepped away from it, and you'll see it when you see it. And I've been in the edit for 8 billion years, it seems, on this. And every time we get to that moment, I think we've seen it, even though we haven't seen it. And I think that audiences are going to fill in a lot of the gaps on their own. Sorry, Michael, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree. I think it's scarier to not show.
Yeah.
You know, I do have to say, because I'm a consumer of true crime, I do feel like Patrick and I are going to get a ton of messages from people who know this case really well, being like, this didn't happen, or that didn't happen, or that's not exactly how it went down. I just want folks to know, we really put a ton of research into this, all of us. And when things are dramatized in just 8 episodes, even though that sounds like a lot of time with a case this big, you know, we just had to condense some things.
Sure.
And, you know, so there are just things, but all of those were conscious choices that we all talked about. We're like, okay, this character is now this sort of amalgamation of these like 4 different detectives. And like, it's just the way we have to do it to make a show in a certain amount of time. Yeah. But it was all done consciously. I can't wait, Bob, for you to see it, and for you to see the actor, Michael Esper, who plays your dad, who's a dear friend of mine, old friend of mine, New York actor. He does a kick-ass job playing Bob Mata.
Awesome.
Awesome.
I'm excited. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it, and I know you guys got a roll, but, when is this thing dropping?
October 16th.
Yep.
Woo. All right.
All 8 episodes available on October 16th on Peacock.
Awesome.
It's certainly one of those where reality is scarier than horror. And if you want to watch something to scare you in October, this would be the one. I was watching it last night on my porch, full moon. There was, some fog out. The clouds were going, a little dim light. Like, this is good. Unfortunately, it was reality, that you're watching of, obviously a dramatization of reality, but it really sucks you in. It really paints, I think, one of the most compelling pictures of this case that's been done. Bravo, you guys. It's quite amazing. Patrick McManus, Michael Chernus, Bob Mana, you guys, thank you for joining us. There you go. October 16th, you said, correct, on Peacock?
That's right.
Drop date. Be ready to watch that. It's when everybody is going to be talking about. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks,
and talking. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.